This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Robert Allerton was born to one of the preeminent families of Gilded Age Chicago. His father, Samuel Waters Allerton, rose from a humble beginning to accumulate a fortune in livestock trading. He also set up the First National Bank of Chicago. The family lived in a mansion on Prairie Avenue amid titans of the age like Marshall Field, George Pullman, and Daniel Burnham. Robert, however, did not follow his father's path. Rather, he embarked on a career as an artist, living and studying in Berlin and Paris before settling in downstate Illinois near Monticello on a piece of property known as The Farms. By then, he had turned from making art to collecting it, with a particular interest in architecture, landscape design, and the decorative arts. In the 1920s, all of this would lead him to meet John Gregg, a young architecture student at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. From the 20s until Gregg's death in 1986, Robert and John referred to each other as father and son. They even made it legally official with Robert's adoption of John in 1960, a few years before the elder man's death. But their relationship, as it spanned decades and continents, was not confined to those traditional bounds. It was, in fact, visibly queer at a time when the perception and reception of homosexuality in American society was undergoing a transformation. All of this is explored in the book An Open Secret, the family story of Robert and John Gregg Allerton, which was published last year. It was written by Nicholas Surrett, who's a professor, chair, and director of graduate studies in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Department at the University of Kansas. Professor Surrett, Nick, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
How did you first become interested, all the way over there in Kansas, in the relationship between Robert and John Gregg Allerton?
Well, at the time I was living in Chicago, but I was in Colorado, but I was doing research for a different book on the history of gender and sexuality in college fraternities. And I was doing research at the University of Illinois in their archives. I was there for a whole week. So I got to talking with the archivist, Lisa Renee Kemplin, and she knew what I was interested in terms of the archives there, gender and sexuality in college organizations. And she asked me, have you ever heard of these guys, Robert and John Gregg Allerton? And I had not. But obviously the University of Illinois now owns their Monticello estate. So she told me about them and I became fascinated.
What was your first reaction upon hearing about them and the structure of their lives and everything else that you went on to write about?
Yeah, so Lisa Renee had told me that, you know, in the area around the university, there was some skepticism, particularly from LGBT people, that they were, quote unquote, really father and son. And I shared that skepticism. Obviously, we're not biologically father and son. But what fascinated me was this notion that as early as the 1920s, they had decided to, sort of as a strategy for being together, that they would assume this identity of father and son. To my knowledge at the time, and I was fairly well versed in queer history, I could not think of other examples of people who had done what they had done. And so they're not super representative. They're not a strategy. What they did was not a strategy that many others took, but I knew it was a fascinating story. And because they were relatively wealthy, or quite wealthy, really, I suspected that they had left behind a good deal of evidence in the archives, which is the case. Most of their papers are at the University of Illinois. And so for a historian, you need archives in order to be able to tell a story, and they had left archives. So there was a possibility, at least initially.
All right. Well, before we get into their story, let's talk a little bit more about what the process of researching this book looked like. You mentioned the U of I archives. What all went into it?
Yeah, so as a historian, I try to simply read everything I can about a given subject. In this case, they had left most of their papers to the University of Illinois, just as they left their house to the university. They also had left some papers in the library of the National Tropical Botanical Garden on the southern shore of Kauai in Hawaii. And that's a garden that they essentially gave seed money to start when it was founded in the early 1960s. So some of their papers were there, some were in Illinois. And you, as a historian, you just sit down and you read and take photographs of everything you can and then try to process it all and synthesize it and come together with an overall narrative. The one challenge that they presented was that they very much stuck to their story. So there is very little evidence in the archives of them talking just to one another about what their relationship really was. It's almost all sort of public facing. This is also the case that, it is also the case that they were together almost all the time from when they met in the 20s to Robert's death in 1964, meaning that they did not have occasion to write to one another. They simply had conversations. And of course, those are not preserved in the archives.
No letters of longing or anything like that.
No letters of longing. There were moments in their early relationship when they were separated, when John was younger and he was traveling in Europe. And there may well have been letters of longing at that time. But if so, either they destroyed them or they simply did not survive or they didn't donate them to the archives.
All right. So can you talk about the way some of Robert's early relationships, like with his stepmother, Agnes, and his best friend, Frederick, how that influenced the way he came to understand family as something that can be chosen rather than just born into?
Absolutely. So Robert was born in 1873. And when he was almost 7 years old, his mother died. And his mother was 39. And within 2 years, so 2 years later in 1882, by this point, Robert is 9 years old, his father remarries and he remarries his aunt, Robert's aunt, not Samuel's aunt. So Robert's mother's younger sister. So all at once, Robert's life has changed in pretty dramatic ways. And what he also sort of learns as a result of this is, one, that it's not particularly strange for an older man to marry a younger person. The difference in ages, Robert's father at that point was 53, and his now stepmother, who's also his aunt, is only 24 years old. And he comes to think of Agnes Allerton, that's his stepmother, as being his mother. Unlike his older sister, who was 10 years his senior and really knew her mother better, who always referred to Agnes as Aunt Agnes, Robert really takes to Agnes as his mother. When he gives money in his mother's honor, it's his stepmother that he gives money in honor of. And his parents, his father and stepmother, never had children of their own. So really he and his sister Kate came to think of Agnes as being like his mother. And one of the arguments I make in the book is that he's not unaccustomed to the notion that you can make up a different family than the biological one into which you are born. And also that large age gaps between people who might be in relationships with one another are not foreign to him either. He grew up in a family where that was common. The other thing to note is that it was somewhat strange that Samuel married his deceased wife's sister.
There I was going to ask you about yes. that. I mean, that's yeah. Shakespearean.
This was, yes. yeah, there when there had been religious and legal prohibitions on what some saw as, it's called afinal incest. So not incest by blood, but incest by previous marriage, in essence. So some people did look askance at that. And clearly Robert grew up in a home there where some people might have thought it was strange, the relationship that his father chose to have with his aunt, who was his mother's sister. I also can answer the question about his friend. So Frederick Bartlett and Robert Allerton grew up together. They were friends from a very early age. They were pretty much the same age. They went to school together for most of their lives, and then they ended up going to art school together in Europe. Frederick Clay Bartlett ended up being a very successful artist known for his art. And Robert, at a certain point, I think largely judging himself against Frederick, found himself to be lacking and so stopped painting altogether. But my argument in the book is that Robert had an affection for Frederick that was absolutely shared, but that for Frederick was superseded by his marriage. He got married and their friendship was never quite the same. And historians have a term for this that they call romantic friendships. And in the 19th century in particular, same-sex romantic friendships were often pretty intense, very emotional, sometimes erotic, though not always, but they didn't necessarily lead to lifelong homosexuality. I think the difference between Robert and Frederick is that Frederick did find companionship with a woman and Robert did not. And so for Robert, it was probably much more jarring when his dear friend with whom he had spent most of his life chose to marry a woman and Robert was simply not interested in doing that.
Fascinating. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Nicholas Surratt, who's the author of An Open Secret, The Family Story of Robert and John Gregg Allerton. And it's about their very unique relationship. They presented to the public as father and son, but as we're hearing, a little more going on than that. And we want to open up the phones. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. If you are in Central Illinois, there's a pretty good chance you've been to Allerton Park, which, as we said earlier, is owned by the University of Illinois. They host a lot of events and retreats. Maybe you've walked the gardens or been to a concert at the music barn out there. 800-222-9455. What do you know, or what didn't you know? What do you suspect about their relationship? 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. So let's continue talking about Robert's path in life. I understand he pursued dreams of becoming an artist. He lived and studied in Europe for 5 years. Why did he give up painting and turn to collecting instead?
He would say repeatedly that he simply realized at a certain point that he did not have the talent to pursue being an artist professionally. At this point, I sort of have to take him at his word. He definitely was being schooled alongside other people who did make a professional career of this. And he may have simply realized it wasn't in him, or he did not have the sort of the vision or the sort of original ideas that others did. That is the way he tells the story. That at a certain point, not all that long after Frederick Bartlett married and moved away from where they were both living in Europe, and that may have had something to do with it as well, that he did not want to stay in Europe without Bartlett. He moved back to Chicago and then eventually moved downstate to outside Monticello.
So in the book, you talk about this concept of an early 20th century queer aesthetic. Can you talk about the ways in which Robert embodied that and explain what you mean when you say he was culturally queer as much as romantically or sexually that way?
Yeah, so none of the things, and I'll give a few examples, but none of the things that Robert did in relation to aesthetics and art and design and collection were inherently queer or inherently homosexual or anything like that. But some of these things culturally had come to have meanings as queer. So here are a few examples. Robert was pretty obsessed with the domestic space. He built this large mansion, Allerton House, that many of your listeners may have been to, and became pretty preoccupied with decorating it in a particular sort of architectural and style. And the interior of houses was coded as a domestic space. Interiors of houses were the domain of women who raised families and cooked and cleaned and so forth. And here was a man, a bachelor, unmarried, who was devoting an enormous amount of time to the interior of his home. And within that interior, he was particularly interested in the decorative arts. So think textiles, porcelain, flatware, that sort of thing. And then also Asian arts. The decorative arts in particular were coded feminine. The decorative, by definition, is artifice. It is something that decorates or, you know, makes pretty. And that again was the realm of the feminine. So his particular interest in the decorative arts was coded as feminine in a way that was seen as unmasculine and thus a little bit queer. And the final piece of this is his interest in these movements at the time, which were called Japonisme, Japanism, or Chinoiserie. That is the sort of the valuing of the Japan, of that which came from Japan and from China. And this was popular among gay men at the time. A number of cultural theorists have written about the way that some people who perceive themselves as outside their culture in one way or another, like a sexually dissident person who did not pursue marriage, was not interested in a quote-unquote normal life, often envisioned new ways of being through embracing other cultural traditions. And so we know that many gay men around the turn of the century really embraced the art and aesthetics of Japan and China. And partially was art and aesthetics because these people did not actually read or speak Japanese or Chinese. So the options really were an embrace of the culture of it, sort of a way of thinking oneself as being different and coming into kinship with other people through embracing different kinds of cultures.
Interesting. Are we to understand this as a form of signaling, to use maybe a modern way of describing
it? Yeah, I think to a degree, yes. So I think that, as I said, none of these things were inherently gay. So there were lots of people who embraced these movements. But to other people like himself, it would have been signaling. And we have lots of evidence from some larger cities of gay men, for instance, like assembling outside Asian-owned stores as a way of signaling to others who pass by that they might be interested in same-sex relations, or styling clubs for themselves that were both bohemian and also Asian in one way or another, dressing up in kimonos, kabuki theater, that sort of thing. So this is a way of finding fellow people in a shared sort of subculture around either the decorative arts or an embrace of Japan and China.
And what this makes me wonder about is our sort of modern understanding of sexual identity and the signaling that takes place as part of that, how that differs from how that functioned in that time period.
So in this period, certainly before the two, John Gregg and Robert, met, and then even during the 1920s when they had met and were first becoming a couple, our contemporary notions of sexual orientation were really only in the developing stage. So doctors and lawmakers were often debating what exactly homosexuality was. Some were convinced that homosexuality was about gender difference. And so they thought of homosexuality more like what we would think of as a trans identity, that is a body or a mind trapped in the wrong body. And others were convinced it had to do more with sexual act, but they had not yet landed on this notion that sexual orientation was about sexual object choice, that is a woman desiring another woman, a man desiring another man. And so, but there was a lot of conversation about it. And so they came to one another at exactly a moment where laws were hardening, trying to prosecute people who were involved in same-sex relationships, where medicine was increasingly pathologizing same-sex relationships as being, you know, a mental illness in essence, and where police were stepping up raids on particular places where they expected to find men engaging in sex with other men. So it was not a remarkably auspicious moment to try to be together as a couple.
Well, we're going to talk about how they tried to do that as a couple when we come back. We're going to continue our conversation with Nicholas Surrett, who's the author of An Open Secret, The Family Story of Robert and John Gregg Allerton. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. 800-222-9455. This is The 21st Show. More to come. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Nicholas Surrett, the author of An Open Secret, The Family Story of Robert and John Gregg Allerton. He's also on the faculty of the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Department at the University of Kansas. The book came out last year from the University of Chicago Press. And the Allertons, as many, many of our listeners will know, lived on a huge estate near Monticello, Illinois. It's now owned by the university. There's a retreat center there, beautiful gardens, a barn that's used for music concerts. A lot of people will have been there. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. If you want to see photos of the Allertons in their prime, you can find them on our website right now at 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. So, Nick, in the book, let me take it back a step. Talk about how Gregg and Allerton actually meet. I understand Gregg is a student at the university at the time, and how they decide to, become a couple, if you will, if that's even the right way to think of it.
Yeah, I think that is the right way to think about it. So you're absolutely right. Gregg was a student at the University of Illinois. He was in the architecture program, and we don't know precisely how they met. They've told many different stories over the course of their life, but we do know that one of Gregg's fraternity brothers was a cousin of Robert Allerton. And so in one way or another, that cousin likely invited Gregg over to Allerton House, and they met that way. We also know that early on in their relationship, Gregg, whose parents had died earlier, Robert served as his sort of stand-in father figure for a father-son fraternity banquet. But we know they had met before that. But they were obviously trying out this father-son business before they actually became father-son in the public eye. And the main argument I make in the book is simply that they had decided at a certain point that they wanted to be together, but they had to have some sort of story to tell people. It would be strange for these two men separated in age by 26 years simply to start living together without some explanation for why it was. And they needed an explanation because of Robert's immense wealth. That is, he was already in the public eye. In 1906, the Chicago Tribune had named him the richest bachelor in Chicago. People expected this man to marry, and they certainly paid attention to what he did when he was in Chicago, especially. He was written about in the papers all the time just for going to the opera, for attending a party, that sort of thing. So if he wanted to bring this young man around with him everywhere he went, they had to have some sort of story. And that was mostly because of how wealthy he was. The wealth also, though, was what allowed them to get away with it. That is, there were very few people in a position to push back publicly on the story. Who was going to call him on it? Who was going to make him change his story? The answer, I think, is really no one. It's clear to me that some people who knew them very well were well aware of what their relationship was, but this language of father and son, and initially they would say foster father and son, that's what appeared in the papers, allowed them to move about together publicly and for Allerton to treat Greg as fully a part of his social world. That is, this was not a young man that he wanted, traveling in second class when he was in first, or not to get the same invitation to the party or anything like that. He wanted him fully included in everything. And so they needed some explanation for that. And what they landed on was father and son. It helped, of course, also that John Gregg's parents were no longer living.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a brilliant solution when you think about it that way, to the, even like you mentioned, the invitation problem or the travel arrangements. And you describe what you just talked about, right? This version of queer couple, I'm quoting from the book now, this version of queer couplehood was developed out of a need based in wealth and also survived because of that same fortune. Was the May-December element here a common feature of this kind of, of a homosexual relationship in the 1920s, or is that unusual as well?
Yeah, so we don't know precisely. My guess would be no, it was not common. That is, there's no way, though, of the census didn't track these things. So tracking people's ages and so forth, especially couples who were trying to stay under the radar, we don't have that kind of information. But it was certainly not a standard feature of same-sex relationships. It sometimes was of more clandestine sexual relationships between older men and younger men. But I think the May-December was somewhat unique, but also that gave them the in that they needed in order to, instead of saying that they were, say, adoptive brothers, which would have been also implausible, they were able to go with father and son because Robert had no children and John at that point had no parents. I think what's particularly interesting is that even if you are not someone in the 1920s who sees through this and thinks, oh, I wonder if they're actually really a couple and this is just what they're calling themselves, they still appear somewhat strange in that Robert is a single man who is not married, who adopts another single man, and then neither of them seems to date or marry anyone at all. Even if we were to believe them in their claim of being adoptive father and son, nothing in that relationship precludes a relationship, like a conjugal relationship with women. And so even for those who might have believed them, they would have found it a little perplexing, I think.
Oh my gosh, there's a new essay that I'm dying to read, which is comparing Batman and Robin of the 1960s with the Allerton-Gregg relationship. Let me ask you, was that you refer to this queer couplehood, was there a path for that in the working classes of the era?
To a degree, but it would have been much more clandestine. So, two working class men, or less likely women, in that one of the things that allowed for people to eschew marriage, that is not get married and live a life outside of marriage, is work. And so most women's jobs didn't pay all that well. So we see the emergence of a really visible queer culture among men before women, because men had the independence of a job, even working class men. There are certainly some examples. Two men could, say, for instance, like live in a boarding house together where their relationship, they might have separate rooms, but they, could have a conjugal relationship with one another. And there are some scant examples of other working class men. We also have a fairly rich archive of working class women in couples, one of whom passed as a man. And they often were legally married to one another in an era when you did not have to produce much documentation in order to get married. And they lived and passed as what appeared to be from the outside a heterosexual couple. And many of these were working class couples.
Fascinating. So why did John Gregg continue to reinforce this idea of Robert's heterosexuality after his death?
That is a great question. That's the kind of question that had Robert or John Gregg still been alive when I was doing this research, I would have loved to have asked him. My supposition is twofold. One, he had not inherited all of the Ellerton estate, but he had inherited a chunk of it, and the rest was in trust, largely to look after the estate in Hawaii. And I think he felt a real sense of loyalty to the Ellerton name. It was only after Robert's death that he took on Ellerton as a surname in the wake of his legal father's death. And so I think he felt like he did not want to change the narrative at that point. And so he wanted to continue to insist that he was the son, which then mandated for him at least saying that Robert was his father and heterosexual and homosexuality had nothing to do with it. I think also, in the era, so Robert dies in 1964 and John lives for an additional 22 years. And this is really the era that homosexuality goes quite public in the United States, the era of gay liberation, and then of course the onset of AIDS. And I think he may have been out of touch with queer culture generally. He had not, they had some gay friends, but he was not really of queer culture, and he might have felt strange sort of aligning himself with it so long after having rejected it. And then I think he probably was also worried that sort of looking at it retroactively, people might have found the whole thing sketchy. That is, they were enacting father and son, but they were really a couple. This might have been difficult for some people to swallow. It would have made them uncomfortable. Those are my guesses as to why he never came clean about it.
Well, in the spirit of understanding people of the past in their totality, and we're coming into the last few minutes of our conversation, I do want to spend a little time on something else you touched on in the book. Was John Gregg an actual Klansman in the 1920s?
We don't totally know. The answer is that he was in a college organization at the University of Illinois called the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK. And these existed at other universities in the Midwest as well. And in his case, there was one representative from each fraternity who was a member of this. We have no evidence that they, for instance, marched, wore robes, that sort of thing. But it's absolutely inconceivable that he did not know of the greater KKK movement, which was quite popular in the Midwest during the 1920s. So at the very least, he was not at all uncomfortable with the notion of aligning himself with a vicious racist organization, even if he was not an active participant in the manner of burning crosses and wearing robes and so forth. So it's not good, for sure.
Yeah, and both Gregg and Ellerton were racist and anti-Semitic, right?
They were. There's plenty of evidence in their letters. They insisted on traveling in certain places where they would not run into people of color or Jews. This is, of course, weirdly ironic because they traveled all over the world where all they did was interact with people of color. They just didn't want their fellow travelers, the fellow hotel guests and people on boats and so forth, to be Jewish or, say, African-American or something like that. So there's evidence of a good deal of racism in their interactions with some of their employees in Hawaii as well. Not all of it quite active, but the prejudices and stereotypes of wealthy white men of their age, to be sure.
So after spending so much time familiarizing yourself with the relationship between Robert and John, as well as their significant philanthropy and their, you know, art patronship, what do you understand to be their legacy?
I think in some ways the legacy is physical in that these two fantastic estates exist that are open to the public that any of us can go see in Hawaii and in or outside Monticello. They also donated an enormous amount to the Art Institute of Chicago and the Honolulu Academy of Arts. If you go to the Art Institute of Chicago, that entrance building is the Allerton building. And many of the pieces inside were donated by Allerton. So that's the physical legacy of their philanthropy. And then to me, the legacy as a historian is understanding how the way that homosexuality was perceived and stereotyped, you know, prevented them from living an open life together. And so they chose this option, an option really that was available to them because they were so privileged in every other way in their life, just not in this one particular way. So it's a way of sort of understanding the options that queer people in the past faced and the decisions that this particular pair of people made.
Do you think, last question, do you think the University of Illinois' Allerton Park and the university in general and the gardens in Hawaii adequately or accurately represent the full story of the Greg Allertons?
I do now. I think that that was not always the case, but the most recent tour I had of the Allerton Gardens in Kauai was quite open about their relationship with one another. And I've actually recently been talking with people working to document some new literature for Allerton House. And they are being quite forthright about the relationship between Allerton and Greg. I think the story is still less told in some other publications that you can find. Not everyone wants to delve into it. And my hope would be that the publication of this book now allows people to, you know, they need not do all this research themselves. They can read this and figure out some language for being able to talk about them.
Well, the book is An Open Secret, The Family Story of Robert and John Greg Allerton. The author is Nicholas Surrett, who's also on the faculty of the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Department at the University of Kansas. Nick Surrett, thank you so much for being with us to share your book with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to have another update on the gubernatorial campaign and also talk about the rally that former President Donald Trump is planning in Adams County outside of Quincy this coming weekend. He's supposed to be endorsing Congresswoman Mary Miller in her campaign against incumbent congressman. They're both incumbents, Rodney Davis. They are competing for the same seat in the primary this year. We're also going to have a conversation about the Heron Massacre, which began 100 years ago tomorrow. It's an incident in which coal miners ruthlessly murdered a number of replacement workers who had been brought in during a union mining strike. Those conversations are coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show. The 21st is produced by Aidan Choate. Our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.